All right, so let's go to James chapter 2. We've been making our way through a study of James' writing. And last time we were together, we were looking at the section in chapter 2, verses 14 through 17. And again, one of the main topics James is going to come back to is the concept of faith. We saw it in chapter 1. And now, again, in chapter 2, he brings it back up. Verse 17 is really a very plain text where he simply writes, "So faith by itself, if it does not have works, is what? Dead." It's empty. It's useless. It has no life in it. So then can we really call it faith? No, it's not faith. Not at least the way he's discussing it. And so that's the idea we carry down in verse 18 as he tries to explain that particular idea even further. So let's read a little bit here and then we'll talk about it. So we'll start at verse 18. Again, this is the English Standard Translation. Here, James writes, "But someone will say, 'You have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works and I will show you my faith by my works.' You believe that God is one. You do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Do you want to know, do you want to be shown, O foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless?" Now, we'll get into Abraham and later into Rahab in just a minute. But in these verses, he's being somewhat sarcastic. When he's asking these questions, is he expecting a response? It's more of a rhetorical question. I don't think he's trying to be belittling, but he is trying to hammer on the idea of this concept of faith only. Now, we define faith how? What are the different ways we see in the religious world that people might try to define how what faith means? What, Doug? Okay. So there in Hebrews 11, verse 1, he says that faith is the substance, right, of things not seen, the conviction or the evidence of things unseen. So there it carries the idea of the belief in the infinite God, right, and his power. Mm-hmm. Well, and my contention would be they are the same thing as long as you're defining them in the correct biblical way.
People say they believe in God. Mm-hmm. But we know if you believe in God, you obey God. So that if you don't believe, if you don't obey, then in reality, you don't really believe.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how they use the term.
Yeah. It really does, yeah, exactly right. It depends on how you define it, because look at the example he gives. He says in verse 19, "You believe God is one." Now, I believe being sarcastic toward those who would say faith only. All you got to do is believe. That's all that God requires. Well, what does he compare you to if you have that attitude? A demon, right? A devil. An evildoer. He says, you're like the demons. The demons have no problem believing in Jesus. They don't have a problem with that. They believe in Jesus, but do they have faith in him? And that's the difference. Not the kind of faith he's talking about here. Of course, we can play with definitions. But the things James does not let us do is he doesn't let us play with definitions when it comes to his writing, because he clearly defines what he means by it. And so what he is not talking about when he says faith, he does not mean that you believe in God. Right? You believe God is one. Okay, great. You have the equivalent faith of a demon. How many demons are going to be in heaven? You think many of them are going to get there? I don't think so, right? And that's kind of the rhetorical part of this. He understands his audience reading this, even in the first century, understands that concept. That you would never call a demon faithful, yet they have no problem with belief. And so when he's talking about faith, it's not just simple mental agreement or assent, but it must be something more than that.
Mm.
Yeah, so just go back to chapter 1, verse 22 about that particular concept. He says, be doers of the word, what? And not hearers only. Is it possible to come to hundreds, thousands of worship services and never leave faithful? That's his point, right? You can go sit in an auditorium and listen to the most outstanding biblical teachers you want to. It has nothing to do with your faithfulness, right? And so there has to be this combination. I'm going to have more to say about that in just a minute. We'll get to Abraham. But this combination between faith and works. And he's going to come back to that in just a minute. Before I go there, do you have something, Jody? Well, what's interesting about that particular example is in Lazarus' case, the Pharisees believed Lazarus was resurrected. They couldn't deny the miracle. That's why they wanted to kill him. There was too many witnesses. Do you expect those Pharisees who wanted to kill Jesus of being faithful to Jesus? No, you wouldn't say that. Let's go back to chapter 2 real quick as we continue this discussion. So I kind of skipped ahead to verse 19. I'll go back to verse 18 for a minute. And then he sets up this, what's the word I'm looking for? This example of one person who has this claim of all you have to do is believe. And what's their claim? Someone will say what? You have faith, right? You have those who claim, I have faith in Jesus. I believe in him. But then you look at their actions, and their actions do not accord with the statement, I believe Jesus. I won't pick on anybody, but you see it on television. How many of us have ever watched a football game when a particular player scores a touchdown and wants to give glory to Jesus? But then you know in their personal life, you hear the stories about how they live. They live in accord with that belief they profess. Not always. I'm not making a blanket accusation against all athletes who do that. But my point is, if you're going to make the statement, then the other part has to accord with it. You have to live that out. Otherwise, it's not really genuine, and it's hypocritical. And so that's kind of the situation he's setting up here when he says, you have faith, I have faith. His perspective is, you say you have faith, but lacking what? Works. I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works. I'll show you my faith by my works. In other words, I think what he's saying is, I won't have to tell you I have faith in Jesus. You can look at how I live my life. That's a demonstration of my faith in Jesus. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's going to be my next thing here. Yeah, so how can you demonstrate faith apart from works? Right? You say you believe in Jesus. How would you possibly show that you believe, prove that you believe or have faith apart from works? Is it possible?
I'd argue with you a little bit. I mean, I think
how? That's works. That's a work. That's a demonstration of faith. That's a work. It's a trust in God. You're showing it by your actions, right? How would I know you don't have stress? Yeah, I'd have to look at your life, and I would see either that's true or not true, right? So even in that claim, that's still a demonstration of you doing something. Mm-hmm. But it's still a work.
No, yeah, I get what you're saying, but it is kind of the opposite of what you're saying, that you're not doing those worldly things, and by not doing those worldly things, it's showing your faith.
Like Jesus sleeping in the
Yeah.
That's a work, right? The sleeping is the work, right? It's still a work, right? You're still demonstrating something by the way you sleep in the boat. The other guys aren't doing that. They're demonstrating what? A lack of faith. When they come up to him and they say, "Don't you care about us? We're dying out here." And then he says, after he calms the storm, what does he say to them? Do you remember? "Oh, you of little faith." So even in that, you're still demonstrating a work. Your work is the fact of the way it's changed your anxiety, how you demonstrate that. So I would still argue that's still a work. I don't think that's anything different. I think it's an impossibility, and that's why James brings it up. He knows there is no way to prove you have faith apart from your works. There has to be something about your life. One time you were stressed about your life, you became a Christian, and now you're not. That's a demonstration of change, is it not? That's work in your life. And so he's going to go from that to then talk about Abraham. And he's going to bring up two examples. We'll spend some time on Abraham and then on Rahab. Let's read this text first. He says, "Was not Abraham," verse 21, "was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac on the altar? You see that faith was active along with his work, and faith was completed by his works. And the scripture was fulfilled that says, 'Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him as righteousness. He was called a friend of God.' You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone." So in verse 24, he restates his conclusion. All right, now he's just giving further proof. And so he brings up Abraham, which is an interesting example because so does Paul. Anybody tell me where Paul brings up Abraham? Romans 4 and verse 3. All right, so if you turn over there, I'm just going to mention it briefly here and make the connection of the two. All right, let's back up to verse 1. So this is Romans 4, verse 1. Okay, now in this section, Paul is discussing, again, justification by faith. Okay, so then shall we say, what then shall we say was gained by Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh? For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him as righteousness. All right, so you have these two statements, and those who proclaim faith only will say, see, what Paul is saying is that Abraham was not justified by his works, but by his faith in God's power to deliver him, in his trust in God, not by his works. And then you go to James, and James makes seemingly, from their standpoint, an opposite view. Is there a conflict between Paul and Peter? And as good Bible students, this is what we have to make a decision about. And if you sit down with somebody who's a Calvinist, whether Calvinist heavy or Calvinist light, and we have all different shades, but Calvinism teaches the concept of faith only, not works that save us. And so any work you do, according to their teaching, is not a work of salvation. The only thing we do to be saved, according to their view, is you just believe. Okay? And they'll go to passages like Romans 4, and they'll dig into this, and they'll say, see, Abraham was not saved by his works. He was saved by his faith. Okay? Scholars, let's go. How do you reckon this? This is important. Okay. That's an important one. So keep that thought in mind. You have to define what works he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think you're hitting down the right road there. Anybody else want to say something about that? How would you answer that question? Number one, is Paul and Peter in conflict? Do you know this, that Luther, who was a faith-only guy, I know he wasn't Calvinist, but he was a faith-only guy. You know, Luther didn't even want, he didn't think James belonged in the Bible. Why do you think he didn't think James belonged in the Bible? It really contradicted what he had to say. But, I mean, it's important for us. Like, are these in conflict? Because if these two passages are in conflict, we've got a big problem going on here. So I do think one of the things Jody mentions is super important. Defining terminology. You can't understand context until you define terminology. So let's talk about that term first, works. As discussed by Paul, when he is looking at the book of Romans, how is he defining works? Yes, so who is Paul talking to? He's talking to Roman Christians and Roman Gentiles. I'm sorry, Roman Jewish Christians and Roman Gentile Christians. They're all Christians, but He's writing to these two separate groups, and the conflict between the two. And really, how do you attain salvation? So as he's writing books like Romans, Galatians, even Colossians, and somewhat in Philippians, but really those three, Romans, Colossians, Galatians, those three books really hit at the false teaching of Judaizing Christianity. You ever heard that term? You ever heard the term Judaizing Christianity? Anybody define that term for the group? What does it mean to be a Judaizing teacher?
Hold on to the Jewish faith in addition to doing
what
baptism
and
Jesus
wanted. They
wanted to hang on the pole.
Yeah, and they didn't want all of the old law, but they wanted elements of it. Like one of the elements they were teaching that was a necessity for Christians was circumcision. So if you were a man and you were a Gentile, you didn't only have to be baptized to be saved. They were teaching that you also had to be circumcised. And if you read the book of Galatians, Paul writes in there about he had to even confront Peter and seemingly Barnabas about this false teaching. These teachers from Jerusalem had come up into Galatia, and this doctrine had even spread as far as the Roman church, where they were teaching, trying to combine these two concepts. So when you look at the book of Romans, at least the first, say, 8 chapters deal with this conflict. Chapter 1 is about how Gentiles are sinners. Chapter 2 discusses the concept that, yes, you Jews are sinners as well. And then chapter 3 is, we're all sinners. It's in chapter 4, though, that you get to the climax of all of that, where he says, yes, we're all sinners, but what? But Christ died for us. Christ is our Savior. Christ brings us grace. And so in chapter 4, as he's discussing this, and he's directing this really at the Jewish Christians, what are you saying to them? The works of the law are not going to save you. If you hold your place here for a second, let's go to one other passage. Go to Galatians 5:4. We could really read 2:4, but Galatians has been called the little Romans because it has so many parallels with this letter. But let's start at verse 2 and let's read through verse 4, okay? So again, he's in the middle of the same kind of discussion about the law and how you can't hold on to the law and hold on to Christ. He says, verse 2, Galatians 5:2, look, I, Paul, say to you that if you accept circumcision, Christ it will be of no what? No advantage, no profit to you. I testify again to every man who accepts circumcision, what? That he is obligated to do what? Keep the whole law. So he's getting rid of this buffet-style religion. He's saying you can't take parts of the old law and try to hold on to it. Either you take the whole thing or you take all of Christ. But you cannot hold on to elements of the old law. Notice verse 4. You who would try to hold on to the old law have done what? You are severed from Christ, you who would be justified by the law. You have what? Fallen from grace. And so for Jewish Christians, they have to make a decision. It's either all of Christ or all of the law. And if you hold to the law, what's the end of that? Death. You hold to Christ, there's life, but you can't do the mix and match. It won't work. It's interesting in verse 4, that term for you've been cut off or severed, it's the idea, the literal idea of cutting off the flesh. Well, he's making a parallel, isn't he, with circumcision. He's really wanting to drive home for them this concept that when you try to hold on to elements of the law, you are cutting yourself off from the grace that is in Christ Jesus. So let's go back to Romans 4 for just a moment. It's this same kind of discussion here. He's going to do it in a little different way. Here in Romans 4, he's going to use Abraham as the discussion point. Why is Abraham significant for a Jewish audience in this discussion? Two things about him. He's the father of the Jewish people, and he's the father of us as well, by the way. And he pre-existed the law. So those two important things, that he pre-exists the law and he is their father. He is their father in what? In faith. So in Romans 4, when he talks about works, he is not defining it the same way as James. Works here has to do with works of the law, not just any kind of work we do for God, but those in particular to do with the law of Moses. So when Paul is disallowing works, the works he's talking about in particular are the works of the law. Now you just continue in that same text, you go down to verse 9, he says, is this blessing then only for the circumcised, or also for the uncircumcised? For we say that faith was accounted to Abraham as righteousness. So, and he's going to continue talking about this topic of circumcision as you keep going. But what he's trying to do is he's trying to say to them that the justification of Abraham did not come as an act of the law. It was not by the law that Abraham was accounted as righteous. Okay, so let's go back now to James. So how do we take that understanding and apply it in James's writing? And I'll have to end here. But I felt like it was important to discuss all this in particular because a lot of people misunderstand this, and there's a lot of false teaching that has developed out of this. So how does James use works different than Paul? Okay. What works has he already discussed? Have any of them had anything to do with the law of Moses? Okay, if you go back to chapter 1, what are the works he mentions here? Okay, if you go to the end of chapter 1, what does he say, Lisa? Okay, one work he says is to visit widows and orphans. And what's the other work? Don't know if he discusses that, but he does say to keep oneself unstained from the world. That's a work. Right? That's something we're producing. That's fruit. Is there any... then you go in chapter 2. What's the work in chapter 2? Helping others. And doing so with what?
No partiality.
No partiality. You're not discriminating over a person's wealth or look, right? You're trying to do good to all men. At no point in here is he discussing the concept of law keeping in regard to the law of Moses. Now, even in the point, the royal law in verse 8, somebody might try to say, well, isn't that in the law of Moses? Is it in the law of Moses? It is. Is that the only place you find it? Where else would you find it? Jesus teaching, Matthew chapter 7. It says, what is the golden rule? We ever say that? What is the golden rule? What was that? Do unto others you have them do unto you. The teaching where he says upon these two hinge the law and the prophets, right? What does he say? To love God and then to love your neighbor. That law, loving your neighbor as yourself, is not an Old Testament law. In Jesus' context, it's his law. That's what we should be doing. You ever heard about the parable of the Good Samaritan? What's the teaching of the Good Samaritan? Love your neighbor as yourself. And every man is my neighbor. So anyway, he also talks about don't commit murder, don't commit adultery. Again, both originally acts of the law, but are they still commanded under the new law? Those are still commanded in the law of Christ. James is not using works in the same way Paul does. The works he's talking about here are what? How would you define works as regarded by James? Say that one more time, Doug. Being obedient to Christ, doing what he's called us to do. When he says in chapter 1, be doers of the word. As Christians, as we've already seen from Paul's writing to the Romans and the Galatians, when he says be doers of the word, what word is he talking about? The new covenant, right? We are new covenant people. And so that's what James is doing. That's how he's using the terminology. And again, notice his example is Abraham, a man who lived before the law of Moses, and Rahab, a Gentile who lived outside of the law of Moses. I know later she converted, but at the time she took those spies in, what was she? A Gentile. She did not live under the law of Moses. She was a Gentile. All right. We'll pick up here. I'm way out of time. Thank y'all for giving me a couple extra minutes there to discuss that. We'll come back. I want to talk a little bit more about Abraham before we move on. So we'll look at verses 21 and following and finish this chapter out. Again, thank y'all for being here and spending this time.